Hello, everyone, and welcome to Discern This, a podcast dedicated to helping us understand global issues. I'm your host, Jim Clancy. October 7th, 2023, Hamas, an organization already branded a terror group by the United States and many other countries, sent hundreds of its fighters, heavily armed, by air, land, and sea into southern Israel. There, they invaded towns and military bases, and they massacred men, women, and children, even infants. It was a textbook definition of terrorism and brutality. The Israeli military was caught completely by surprise, but it was no surprise when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared war. Joining us to help us understand better from the Palestinian perspective what is happening here, the origins of Hamas, and much more, is Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. He is the leader of the Palestinian National Initiative. He is a longtime proponent of peace negotiations and an opponent of the use of force. Dr. Barghouti, thank you so much for joining us. I want to begin here and just ask you, did October the 7th change everything, all of our calculations in the Middle East?
It definitely had a great impact, and definitely Netanyahu, who in my opinion, and I hope you will accept that, is a war criminal, not only towards Palestinians, but also towards Israelis, because he insistently and continuously destroyed any possibility for peace in this region. His plan, actually, he wants to use the 7th of October to change the map of the Middle East. And actually, the map he wants to achieve, if I may say so, the map he wants to achieve is the map he held in front of the whole world in the United Nations, in the General Assembly, only 3 weeks ago. A map that includes where Israel is including not only West Bank, which he annexes, but also Gaza Strip, at the time when Israel was still claiming that it has withdrawn from Gaza. So a map of Israel that includes West Bank, Gaza Strip, Golan Heights, in a blunt violation of international law by annexing occupied territories. This is the map he wants to achieve.
Hamas, however, launched all of this with extraordinary viciousness. And I'm sure the question among Palestinians, I know it is in the outside world, why? Why commit massacres?
Massacres cannot be justified in any way. And you know my frank position, Jim, very well. I am a person who always advocated nonviolence, and I am against the killing of any civilian. But I don't think they planned massacres. I think what happened is that Hamas found itself, and to understand what was going on, we have to go back like at least a few months behind, and then maybe more. First of all, during the last 8 months, the Israeli army and Israeli settlers terrorized Palestinians in the West Bank and killed no more than 248 civilian Palestinians, including 40 children. During this period of time, they attacked Al-Aqsa Mosque more than once, tried to change the nature of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is a very holy place, attacked not only Muslim holy places, but also Christian holy places, spitted on clerics, on Christian religious leaders, on people who came to pray in the churches in Jerusalem, even to on foreigners. In addition to that, they declared very clearly that their plan is the annexation of the West Bank and as well as Gaza Strip, as I told you about this map. And in the process, they showed that there is no perspective or hope for any kind of peaceful resolution. But the core problem is not even that. The core problem is this continuous occupation, which has become the longest occupation in modern history. 56 years of military occupation of West Bank and Gaza Strip that has transformed into a system of apartheid, a much worse apartheid than what prevailed in South Africa at one point of time. And more than that, it's the problem of refugees. 70% of the Palestinian people were ethnically cleansed by Israeli troops in 1948, becoming a huge number of Palestinian refugees. By the way, 70% of the people of Gaza today are refugees from 1948. So it's a continuous lack of progress towards any peace. And in my opinion, Netanyahu succeeded in blocking any possibility for that.
We're going to talk more about Benjamin Netanyahu, the peace process, and all those related issues. But I want to go all the way back. How did Hamas end up in Gaza?
You know, in the 70s, Jim, and you know that very well, Israel was fighting the PLO, the secular PLO. And what they say now about Hamas, that it is a terrorist organization, they used to say about PLO as well and about Fatah. As a matter of fact, up till this moment, not Hamas only is described as terrorist in the American Congress, but Fatah as well and the PLO in general. And that's why there is this law in the Congress that prevents the reopening of the PLO offices in Washington. In the 70s, they were fighting the PLO. And at that time, they didn't care much about Islamic movements, which they thought will never engage in struggle against Israel. Eventually, when the Intifada started, of course, the Islamic movement, the first Intifada, the Islamic movement found themselves, with so many young people in them, obliged to join the Palestinian struggle for liberation. And then it evolved. In 2005, after the re-invasion of the Palestinian territories, which Sharon did, and practically the destruction of all the structures of the Palestinian Authority, both in West Bank and Gaza, Sharon decided to withdraw from Gaza without even coordinating or negotiating that with the Palestinian leadership. And it was clear, it gradually became very clear that after 2006, when Hamas won democratic elections, that Israel was adamant at separating West Bank from Gaza. As a matter of fact, this was prepared for since 1993. The funny thing is that before Oslo Agreement, we could travel to Gaza easily. Students from Gaza could easily come to the West Bank. We were one unit. After 1993 and signing Oslo Agreement, Israel blocked movement from West Bank to Gaza, blocked movement from West Bank to Jerusalem. So in my opinion, they prepared the ground for a possible division between West Bank and Gaza, which they encouraged later and consolidated by taking a stand against free democratic elections in Palestine again.
Dr. Barghouti, as I look back, I remember watching Hamas come in. The Israelis gave them permission because they wanted them to replace the PLO. It was a policy of anybody but Arafat, so they would funnel aid to them, not realizing what Hamas would become.
That's one way of putting it. Of course, Israel enjoyed the internal division among Palestinians and tried to encourage it in every possible way. Our response to that was that we should have a free democratic system. Our response was that we should have a fully proportional system for elections. And we pushed for elections. And all the polls showed very clearly that Hamas would not get a majority if we had elections, but Fatah also would not get a majority. We would have ended up with a truly pluralistic system. The question here is, why did Israel obstruct any possibility for elections? Of course, the Palestinian Authority was also responsible. Why the United States took a stand against free democratic elections in Palestine? I believe that had we have elections in 2021, we would have a different pluralistic system that could have opened a situation where neither Hamas nor Fatah could have one party rule in West Bank and Gaza.
But the U.S. was there to say, look, you can't have a terror group running on the ballot in your elections. At the same time, Israel was directing cash to Hamas in order to replace the PLO and its role inside Gaza. This was March of 2019, quoting from Prime Minister Netanyahu. Anyone who wants to thwart the establishment of a Palestinian state has to support bolstering Hamas and transferring money to Hamas. This is Netanyahu speaking to members of his own Likud party in private. He said, this is part of our strategy.
First of all, to be accurate, Israel did not give money to Hamas, but allowed money to come to Hamas from other countries and basically to support the people who are in poverty in Gaza. That is the funding from Qatar.
Correct. It controlled the flow of cash.
Yeah, exactly. But what you said is very accurate, and it leads us to questioning the whole strategy of Netanyahu. Netanyahu's game was, and unfortunately this became the American administration game, if Palestinians speak to Hamas and talk about national unity and elections, then they are dealing with terrorists, and that is unacceptable. But then if Palestinians want to negotiate with Israel, I mean Mr. Abbas, Netanyahu would say, I wouldn't negotiate with him because he doesn't represent all Palestinians. So the game was to consolidate this internal division and to use it as an excuse for not talking to Palestinians in general. Although Hamas, in several meetings, have declared that they are accepting that Mr. Abbas would represent Palestinians in any good negotiations. But let's go back to the reality of Netanyahu. In 1993, when the peace agreement was concluded between Palestinians and Israelis, Netanyahu personally aggravated the Israeli public openly against Yitzhak Rabin. And his aggravation led to the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, the prime minister of Israel, who signed the peace agreement with Palestinians. And after Rabin was assassinated, Netanyahu came to power in 1996. And since then, with the exception of short periods of time, he was running Israel. And in the process, he declared, he didn't hide, he wrote that in his book in 1994, A Place Under the Sun, that he would never accept or allow the creation of a Palestinian state. He would never allow the implementation of Oslo Agreement. And he consistently and continuously destroyed any potential for peace negotiations or peace process. And since 2014, no Israeli leader would meet with Palestinian leaders. So practically, Netanyahu is now fulfilling his promise, fulfilling his dream of destroying any potential for peace, of destroying any potential for Palestinian statehood. And even more than that, he's advancing with the fascists in his government, like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, the idea of annexation of occupied Palestinian territories, whether we are talking about West Bank or Gaza Strip.
Where does that all leave us then, Dr. Barghouti? I know you have three basic points. One of them is an immediate ceasefire, an exchange of hostages, and then serious work on a political settlement.
That's true. But before responding to this, let me also remind you of the fact that the whole world has become convinced, or not the whole world, but big parts of the world are convinced that what Israel has created because of this long occupation is a system of apartheid. That's what Amnesty International says. That's what Human Rights Watch says. And I don't think anybody can undermine or not respect these groups. Even the Israeli B'Tselem organization, the most respected human rights organization in Israel, also said this is a system of apartheid. Netanyahu's resolution of this matter, the fact that we are in apartheid, that he is conducting an apartheid system, it seems he is thinking about resolving that by ethnic cleansing. If he removes the people of Gaza out of Gaza now to Egypt, and that's what he's pushing for. And I am so shocked that some American officials are saying, yes, there should be a corridor not to provide food and medicines to the people in Gaza who are besieged, but to let people of Gaza leave to Egypt. Netanyahu said every Palestinian in Gaza should evict their home. Where to go? To the sea? And then his spokesman, the military spokesperson of Netanyahu, made it clear. And this was the headline in Yediot Ahronot 2 days ago. He said, the Israeli official military spokesperson said every person in Gaza should leave their homes and go to Egypt. So you are talking about an act of ethnic cleansing, which I think Netanyahu thinks would resolve his problem of apartheid. He's not thinking only of ethnic cleansing in the Gaza Strip, but also in the West Bank. So far, we have had 20 communities in the West Bank evicted by Israeli settlers' terror. And this is what we have in this government. So basically, Netanyahu is trying to push the situation now towards a very long war, hoping that this would lead to ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Gaza. And he is refusing the three things I've spoken about, as you said, immediate ceasefire, de-escalation and immediate exchange of prisoners. But this Netanyahu doesn't care even about the Israeli prisoners. He knows very well that with each airstrike, he's risking killing them. He doesn't care. And all he cares about is to stay in power. And he knows that any inquiry now in Israel will demand that he should resign. And he knows that if he resigns, he will go to courts. And there are 4 cases of corruption against him. And he will eventually probably end up in jail. So he's trying to defend his presence as prime minister at every possible way. And he doesn't care about the lives of Palestinians or the lives of Israelis. He only cares about himself. And now he is in total joy because the United States is accepting his concept. The United States is getting involved in a process of dehumanizing not only Hamas, but the whole Palestinian population. And that is, I never thought we will get to that point. I never thought that ethnic cleansing would be possible in the 21st century. But this is what these monsters are trying to do.
Clearly, there are few options for the Palestinians that are now living in Gaza. If they leave for Egypt, I doubt they would be let back in.
Absolutely. Of course, that's the game. They want them out, and they will never allow them back. They want to throw the Palestinians on Egypt and throw the Palestinians in the West Bank on Jordan. And this is not like a secret. I mean, Sharon said it so many times, that Jordan is the Palestinian alternative home. And this is what these guys think about. It's so racist, so inhuman, so unacceptable. But what worries me most is the unconditional American adoption of Israeli narrative. I wish I didn't see the day when the American president would speak in such an irresponsible manner, discriminating between Americans, discriminating between American Palestinians and American Israelis. He spoke about the American Israelis who were killed because they carry, of course, Israeli citizenship. But he didn't say a word about the 500 American Palestinians who are stuck now in Gaza and being bombarded with airstrikes. He didn't do anything to force Israel to at least indict one of the soldiers who shot to death Shirin Abu Akleh, the most peaceful journalist who was Palestinian, American, Christian, and who was shot to death by an Israeli sniper. Nothing was done to indict any Israeli soldier for doing that.
As we look at the situation developing right now, Dr. Barghouti, I see that the United States is still intensely focused on that Saudi-Israeli peace deal that they are trying to promote. Some say to benefit the position of the United States in the Middle East.
Yeah, and look how things are reversed. How things are put on their head instead of standing on their feet. Now we hear propaganda, even from American officials, not only Israelis, saying that Hamas made the attack to prevent peace between Saudi Arabia and Israel. Saudi Arabia was not in war with Israel. Emirates was not in fight with Israel. Bahrain was not having a problem with Israel. Morocco did not have a problem with Israel. The problem is with Palestinians, because they occupy our land, because they oppress us, because they put us under a system of apartheid. But the whole game that was initiated by Netanyahu in cooperation with, the American president, it was to negate the Palestinian question, to shelf away the Palestinian question, to bypass the Palestinian issue, and create this normalization with Arab countries at the expense of Palestinians so that the Palestinian issue would be liquidated. This was the meaning of Trump's plan, and this is the meaning of this whole work about normalization without implementing the Arab Peace Initiative, which said that there will be normalization if Israel ends occupation and allows Palestinians to have a state of their own.
Do the events of October 7th close the door on the aspirations of the Palestinian people? Those events certainly don't enhance them.
No, they don't. And it would be a very wrong impression if people think that Palestinians will stop struggling for their rights. Look, my whole family lived under occupation. I've never have seen a day of freedom, neither my father nor me nor my daughter. And what we want is like what other people in this world want. Peace, freedom, democracy, equality, and security. And the big lesson about what happened, regardless of the atrocities and everything, is that Israelis cannot have security and peace without Palestinians having security and peace. The road to peace is through solving the Palestinian issue, allowing us to be free from occupation and free from the system of apartheid. There is no other way. And nobody should have any illusion about us accepting a life of enslavement under apartheid or any other form of oppression. This will not succeed. We will also not accept another ethnic cleansing. We will struggle with every way we can to achieve what other people have achieved, which is our freedom. You know, I always use the phrase of a very famous Palestinian poet whose name was Tawfiq Ziyad, and he happened to have been the mayor of Nazareth. He said a very interesting phrase once. He said, "We, the Palestinian people, are not better than any other people in this world. But no other people in this world are better than us." That's our spirit. We want to be equal to others. We want to be treated in a human manner. We want to be treated in a way that does not drag us from one war into another and does not drag us from losses of lives and suffering that doesn't stop.
How do you maintain hope, Dr. Barghouti, in your hopes for negotiated settlement? Critics would say you don't have the support of ordinary Palestinians living in the refugee camps in Jordan and elsewhere around the Middle East. How do you expect to move it forward?
I totally disagree with this assumption. I think during these days in particular, we've seen tremendous support of the public to the views we carry and to the positions we take and to our insistence on our rights and even to our approach of struggling and supporting nonviolent resistance. I do believe that, and I think this can be checked in every... we're running third in any polls that happen, I mean, after Fatah and Hamas. But neither of them can get majority. So the perspective is very wide. But now the most important thing for us is not to think about results of elections, but about stopping this terrible war, stopping this atrocity that is taking place, and saving our people in Gaza from all this bombardment, which has taken already the lives of 400 innocent children.
Do you have any international support for this endeavor?
Yeah, I think we are perceived rightly about in our approach and in our work. We don't get money from anybody, of course. We don't want that. We rely on our people. But we think that our approach eventually is the one that will be accepted and adopted because it's the right one. I will never lose hope. And I say it frankly, although it sounds very, very, very difficult now and it sounds impossible, if Israel kills the two-state solution, and probably it will, the only solution to one apartheid state will be one democratic state where we will live together in equality, accepting each other with equal national and civil rights. There is no other way. One of my best friends is the Israeli musician Daniel Barenboim, and he always used a phrase that I like. I used to say to him, knowledge is the beginning, and that became the title of a very good DVD about the performance of West East Divan in Ramallah, which I organized. And I used to say knowledge is the beginning, and he used to say sometimes the impossible is easier than the difficult. I believe in the future. I am hopeful, regardless of all what is happening. And I think that eventually people with goodwill will see the problem and the plight of the Palestinian people and will understand that we are entitled to freedom like everybody else.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, I want to thank you very much for being with us on the Discern This podcast at this very critical time for everyone in the Middle East. I'm Jim Clancy.
Thank you so much. Take care.
If you like what you heard here on Discern This, I urge you to tell your friends about this podcast and share it with them as we try to bring a better understanding of global issues.